Hello. My name's Forrest. Forrest Gump. Do you want a chocolate? I could eat about 1.5 million of these. My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get.
Chocolate. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Primary Care Pearls, a podcast made by learners, for learners, and most importantly, led by our patient stories. Today, we are very excited to talk about food.
Nutrition is the leading global risk factor for death in the world. Causes about 11 million deaths globally, and that's independent of high blood pressure, that's independent of diabetes, that's independent of high cholesterol. It's even more than smoking. And that's a lot. These are patient lives that are in the mix, that are people that are unhappy, that are unhealthy, that are taking a ton of medications, that don't feel well, that are searching to us as their primary care doctors for answers, and we don't always have them. And not that nutrition is the only thing that's important, but it really has the power to help prevent, help treat, help even reverse a lot of chronic diseases, while also not making people live longer and just having it feel like they're living longer, actually to add joy to their lives as well.
During our discussion, we'll be joined by Tina, a patient struggling with nutrition.
This is Tina. Food is exciting, and food is just like you're having a good time. So food equates a good time.
Right. And if it stops being fun, then what's the point?
Right.
We'll learn more about her personal motivations for changing her nutrition plan and the emotional struggles she's faced while doing so. We'll also be joined by a resident expert and a good friend of mine from the Yale School of Medicine.
I'm Justin Charles. I'm one of the residents in the Yale Primary Care Program. Really passionate, interested about nutrition and lifestyle medicine, and excited to talk to Tina today about nutrition and her journey.
You know, one of my favorite things about you, and one of the reasons I'm so happy that we're able to have you here on the podcast, is that you are able to understand this stuff at the level of a physician, at the biochemical level, knowing the different names of the compounds, what foods they're present in, and the negative impacts that they have on the body. But you're able to, I think, convey that in such a no-nonsense, easy way to patients, as was obvious with your discussion with Tina. So I think that's why we're so lucky to have you here today. This discussion will be the first part of a four-part series that will explore eating habits, the psychological underpinnings of eating behavior, and strategies for the primary care provider to address them. My name's Nate Wood, and I'll be your host for this episode. We hope that through this discussion, you'll develop confidence about what we in the scientific community know about healthy eating, and that you'll also be inspired to understand your patients' backgrounds before engaging with them about changing their diet. Before we get started, please know that this content is meant to be for learning and entertainment purposes only and should not be used to serve as medical advice. If you or a loved one is suffering from anything discussed in today's episode, please be sure to discuss it with a medical expert. Okay, with that, let's get started.
One thing that really underpins a lot of this discussion is how people's early life and other experiences impact how people eat and their eating behaviors. There's a lot going on beneath the surface related to issues of control, issues of trauma, issues of feeling loved that go into why people eat a certain way or don't eat certain things. And it's really crucial to develop an understanding of that as we're going to help people make changes. It's not just about telling people what to do. It's about understanding their story. I think Tina mentioned something about this, which really stuck with me. Tell me about your relationship with food. Food, I feel like, plays a lot of different roles in our life. And there's the nutrition part, there's the taste part, there's the comfort part. And I just want to hear more from you where that fits in with everything.
I like the way it tastes. I don't like the way it affects me physically and visually. Because we're always our own worst critic. And when I see myself, like, it's just disgusting. And I want to lose weight. I try to follow your advice, but it's hard because everything is just like I'm an emotional eater. I'm eating because somebody else is eating. I'm eating because of my job. I'm eating because I remember what something else tasted like before, so I want to try it again. It's kind of like drugs.
Yeah, food can really have a pull on us and affect us in a whole spectrum of ways. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, I think, starts from how we eat and how food affects us when we're growing up. What was eating and healthy eating or not healthy eating like for you in your childhood?
Well, in my childhood, we grew up extremely poor. So everything was just like you ate what you ate. Now I get to make my own decisions as far as food is concerned. So I eat whatever I want to eat when I want to eat it.
Mm-hmm. So it was a little more of a scarcity state and get Correct. What you can then. And now that you're in a better position, you can
eat whatever you want to eat.
Right.
So I'm making up for lost time.
There's a certain power in that and sense right. of control, right?
Yes.
Things feel out of control in our world. And so we control the things we can. And then other parts of our life feel more out of control too.
Yes.
What's it been like in terms of your diet journey? I hate the word diet, but your nutrition journey.
Okay. I think the two things that worked the best for me, they did work. It's just I got happy with the results and I stopped. Mm-hmm. Number one was the low-carb stuff, the keto. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like the way it affected me and made me feel. Like I had headaches constantly. I felt terrible, but I liked the way I looked. Mm-hmm. So I was like, who cares how I look? I want to feel better.
Right.
So I started eating what I wanted to eat. Then when you told me about the plant-based diet stuff, that worked well until my daughter made some chicken. Mm-hmm. And then I felt like I ate that chicken, I might as well keep eating.
Right.
So I never went back fully on that.
Got it. So it's been kind of a roller coaster.
Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like that happens a lot where we're on track with something and then one little thing and then we just veer entirely off. Mm-hmm. Before we talked, what was your view of eating healthy?
I wanted to do it. My thing is this, when the doctor tells you to do something, you try to do it. So I try to follow you to the letter. But then, like I said, I messed up. And so being that you're the doctor, you would know more about it than me. So I had to put my feelings aside and try to incorporate your views and everything.
And before you learned about my views, what was your view on what's healthy, what's unhealthy? How did you think about making healthy choices from a conceptual standpoint?
Well, my conception of nutrition was things that were good for you, full of vitamins and nutrition and things of that nature. But what I wanted to have was sweets, because mostly my diet consists of cakes, cookies, sugary stuff.
Right.
No real food. Nothing's real food. Mm-hmm. You get full off of a soda and a bag of potato chips and some ringdings.
Right.
So nothing was really ever food. It was always sweets and junk.
Right. And it's always that battle between, in a lot of cases, what tastes good and what I know I should be eating. Mm-hmm. And I found that it can be really helpful when those two things aren't at odds anymore.
Now, I know we're only just a couple minutes into this episode, but already I feel like we've learned so much and are so blessed by Tina's story. She is motivated to change. She really takes into consideration what her doctor recommends and has such good insight into some of the influencers on her diet. You know, she mentions that she eats kind of what's easily available around her. She discusses some of her previous experiences with food insecurity and how that impacts her diet even today, and what she thinks she needs to eat in order to lose weight. And then Justin mentions a couple of other possible factors. He mentions, some things just taste good, and other times we're eating because it makes us feel like we're in control. So already we're learning about all these different facets of what eating means and all of these potential environmental influences that can impact how we eat on a day-to-day basis. But I'm really excited for what comes next, which is one of everyone's most favorite things about food.
a lot of people think, oh, well, I'm going to watch what I'm eating, and that means that food no longer is this pleasurable thing. It's this bland, soggy, boiled spinach that tastes bitter and sulfury, and there goes this whole joyous part of my life.
Food is exciting. And food is just like you're having a good time. Like lately, I've been going out with my sister. We go out to Chili's or somewhere, and we're having a good time. Like my boyfriend, we go out to eat, and we're relaxing, and we're eating. So food equates a good time.
Right. And if it stops being fun, then what's the point?
Right.
Food should be a joyful experience. There's a difference between using it as a self-soothing and wanting your food to taste good and be colorful and make you happy and feel full and that you're not starving yourself. And there's this dichotomy that people think that either food can be healthy or food can be tasty. And it can really be both. Do you think there could be any way, this is a leading question, I know it, that eating healthy or eating healthier could still have the fun and the joy, even if it's not a life's an open buffet and I can right. eat whatever I want?
Well, I don't know any place that you could go to and eat healthy food and have a good time.
You know, I remember my grandma growing up, she would say, oh, this tastes good, so it must not be healthy for me. And that was something that she had just realized as gospel. The more food that she ate, the longer she'd been on earth. If it tasted good, it wasn't good for her.
Now, not everyone needs to be a professionally trained chef like you to be able to cook a really healthy meal. There is a lot of push for culinary medicine and for patients to be able to get in the kitchen, even with limited skills, even with limited supplies, even with not the highest quality, most expensive ingredients, and still be able to put flavors together in a way that makes something tasty, no added experience required.
And I think Tina actually really nicely exemplified why this is so important.
There can be a lot of natural flavors in foods that can taste really good, especially when we know how to combine ingredients right way. What's your relationship been with cooking?
I don't cook. I can't cook. Nobody cooks at the house, really. Like, my daughter, she'll cook some stuff, but everything is fried. Mm-hmm. Everything is fried. Then I eat at work, and I eat out on the street. So it's easier to go to fast food restaurants because they cook the food for you. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about fast food is it's fast and it's there. You
it's
don't have to wait.
And it's there. You don't have to do anything.
I'm just making it's not an excuse. I'm just saying that's why I mess up all the time, because I get to the point where I don't make it as good as the other people make it. When you told me about the plant-based diet stuff, that worked well until my daughter made some chicken. Mm-hmm. And then I felt like I ate that chicken, I might as well keep eating. You know what I mean?
You said your mom used to cook for you back in the day?
Yeah.
What was that like?
She couldn't cook. Now I know better what food tastes like. She can't cook. She couldn't cook. She didn't use seasoning. She didn't use any of that stuff. She would just like salt and pepper was the seasoning. And then she would cook the food just as basic and bland. But
it was all you knew.
Yeah. So then once you start going over to your friend's house and their mothers could cook, then that's what you want. You don't want that stuff she's cooking.
Have you eaten anything healthy before that you thought was really tasty? And what made it so good?
I love watermelon. I can eat watermelon, like a whole watermelon. So, yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, during the summertime, I can't keep buying them because I'll keep eating them. Nobody's getting them, just me.
And I love that she says that, because I think it's not just her that has this issue, right? So many people do not know how to cook, and we don't realize that that can be such a big barrier to people improving their health. You know, she even mentions something healthy that she likes to eat, right? And what was it? Fresh fruit, watermelon, right? That requires no cooking. It requires you to cut it up, and that is it. And so that's a red flag, I think, when we're talking with patients. Another one is like if you ask them to name some of their healthiest foods that they enjoy eating, and they can only name salads, right? These are things that do not require cooking. You just throw them together in a bowl. And then before you know it, you end up at the end of your rope. Like she said, I had gone through all the flavorful things I knew how to make. And, you know, that's in that moment, she felt week and looked at chicken, right? Because that was something that was cooked and different, which is so not what she had been eating previously. Eating food that tastes good and eating food that is good for you do not have to be mutually exclusive. This is so attainable, and it's my life passion, you know, to empower people to enjoy food in a healthy way. What are the key components of healthy eating?
I think the most important thing is to look at food quality. We too often break down into macronutrients or including this and not including that, and carbs are bad, fat is bad, protein is good, butter is back, and all of these different things, instead of really looking at what are healthful components of food, what are unhealthful components of food, and which foods have more healthful components and the least amount of unhealthful components, and design a diet around that.
And that, I think, is the key message here, that a lot of times we view good nutrition or a good healthy diet as a long laundry list of things that we cannot eat. But when we think about it in this other way, when we flip it on its head and say, actually, let's focus on the things that give our body some benefit in some way, what things are health promoting, and we instead focus on that, it becomes less about the laundry list of things that we should stay away from and more about eating good, nutritious foods that nourish our body. And I think that frame shift for so many people, I know for myself, has been and can be really, really powerful.
You look at things like fiber, which 95% of Americans are deficient in, more than any other vitamin or mineral. So we want food that has fiber. We want food that has enough vitamins and nutrients. We want food that has phytochemicals and antioxidants and anti-inflammatory compounds. We want food that's low in calorie density, meaning per given weight of food, there's a lower amount of calories. So we can consume more of it and not necessarily get too many calories. And we want low amounts of things that are more harmful, lower amounts of saturated fat, lower amounts of things like preservatives and nitrates and nitrites that have been linked to cancer, lower amounts of heme iron, TMAO, new 5GC, other harmful components that raise cholesterol, raise inflammation, cause heart disease. And when you boil that down, it comes to eating foods that are minimally processed and eating mostly plant-based foods. And that's where the whole food plant-based diet comes into being. It's not to cut out fat or cut out protein or cut out this. It's which foods are more health promoting: vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, avocados, nuts, and seeds. Which foods are generally more health harming: the animal products, the meat, the poultry, the fish, although that's a little debatable, the eggs, the dairy, and the processed foods, the brownies and cookies and chips and crackers and pretzels and white rice and white breads and added oils and TV dinners. And it leads to a pretty common sense way of eating.
So just to briefly summarize, those things that we can eat that are health promoting, that the preponderance of evidence really has told us across generations, across many different types of studies, across decades of research, that we've really learned are healthy for us, are things that grow in the ground, right? Fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes, whole grains. And then as we focus on eating more and more of those things, we can kind of allow the less health-promoting aspects of our diet, things like many animal products and ultra-processed quote-unquote foods that are high in added salt, oil, sugar, all of that stuff, we can kind of just let it be crowded out as we focus on eating those healthier foods. But of course, as data-minded practitioners, we're all very much interested in truly what the research does say. What is the evidence behind this type of diet? So next, I'm going to ask Justin some questions along those lines.
You keep touching on this point that nutrition is so complicated. I think we would be simple-minded to think that it's ever going to be easy to study. It's such a complex issue and requires complex research methods, I think, to study it effectively.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when we try to boil it down to one specific variable, we really miss the boat. A lot of the early studies looking at vitamins and antioxidants did exactly that. They, like I mentioned with the orange before, said, oh, vitamin C. When people eat oranges, they get healthy. Let's extract the vitamin C from the oranges, put them into pills, give them to people, and they'll get healthier. And they didn't. So a lot of the times, even though we're well-intentioned of trying to simplify this and trying to apply this reductionist view, which is really helpful in a lot of areas, it just misses the boat when it comes to nutrition. And it still boils down to eating foods in their natural state tends to lead to better outcomes.
So how much do we really know? You know, thinking about this phrase, evidence-based nutrition, a lot of people would push back on that and say, oh, that's a misnomer or that's oxymoronic. But you, knowing the state of the literature, I'm curious what your thoughts are on what we know for sure and what is still up for debate.
We live in a world where science is not a static thing. Everything is changing. But that being said, we have decades, if not centuries, of research of general nutritional principles. You have some critics that say, well, anything observational, there could be biases, and it's not good methodology, and we should just throw it out altogether. And it's important to keep an eye on what those biases are. But for one, not all nutrition research is observational. Look at the PREDIMED study, looking at the Mediterranean diet, which is a mostly plant-based, minimally processed diet. Over 6,000 people in a very well-done randomized controlled trial published in New England Journal of Medicine within the last decade. We have randomized controlled trials and meta-analyses and systematic reviews that are high quality, published in peer-reviewed leading journals that discuss nutrition that a lot of people would say that's the gold standard. So the idea that all nutrition research is observational is a myth. Secondly, observational research can still be really useful when paired with the general preponderance of the evidence. If we have one study that said cherries are good for you, and then a lot of others, you know, you can make one study say anything depending on how you design it. But when we look back at large-scale epidemiologic studies like Adventist Health Study, like the China Study, all of these studies that are done that show more predominantly plant-based diets lead to longevity, reduce the risk of chronic disease in large populations. So if you look at any one of these things in isolation, I agree it's not enough. But when you look at decades and decades of literature with randomized control trials, with observational studies, with proposed mechanisms, you really get a much more clear picture than a lot of people want you to think. Nutrition's also very different than trialing a drug. When we say we have this one drug, that is the only variable that we're going to change. It is, do you get lisinopril or do you not get lisinopril? And that lends itself to a double-blinded placebo randomized control trial and the gold standard. But when we're trying to change someone's diet, that can't just be one thing. It's so complicated what goes into nutrition, even looking at the difference in vitamin C between oranges and how bioavailable that vitamin C is and how much magnesium is also with that vitamin C and how different people process it. We could either spend 100,000 years trying to reverse engineer an orange, or we could say, maybe the orange is just healthy enough and we don't need to know every single reason why. Some people might say that's unscientific. I say it's just not being insane. And at a certain point, we need to say, this is good enough, it has low harms, and as we continue to find more and more mounting evidence, we do have a preponderance of evidence in line with a more minimally processed and plant-based diet.
I love that. And if you're anything like me, it's left you wanting to know more, right? We want to know more studies, more evidence. Give me more of that research. But remember, this is only episode 1 of 4 in our nutrition series, so there will be plenty of time for that in future episodes. You'll just have to come back to hear more. Here are some takeaways that I took from today's episode, and I hope you will too. Number one, and I think this is one that we often miss or overlook or sometimes are just too busy to really attend to, and that is getting to know our patients' backgrounds is a very important prerequisite for understanding the role nutrition plays in their lives. Number two, my favorite, eating healthy can be a joyous experience. So if any of us personally has not yet embraced this truth, please, now is the time. As we learn more and more about nutrition and how to achieve a healthy diet, or maybe at least a healthier diet in our own lives, we can then help our patients realize this for themselves as well. And number three, to provide everyone with a little bit of reassurance, there is indeed robust literature available to help guide us as providers on how to counsel our patients about healthy eating. And most of the evidence, it seems, really does support eating a minimally processed diet that's high in plants, like the whole food plant-based diet that Justin introduced today. Be sure to tune in next time, wherever you listen to your podcasts, to catch part two in our four-part series, where we'll introduce some of the various diets Tina has tried in the past, including that ubiquitous keto diet that we're all familiar with by now, in addition to taking a deeper dive into the whole food plant-based diet. As much as I love food and could spend all day talking about it, that does conclude our episode for today. We hope you enjoyed and were able to learn something as well. This episode was made possible by contributions from our patient, Tina, and Dr. Justin Charles, who served as our patient interviewer and expert, and also provided peer review for this project. Special thanks to our producers, Madison Swallow, August Aloko, Helen Tsai, and Dr. Joshua Onyango, as well as our faculty advisor, Dr. Katie Gielison. Be sure to follow us at PC Pearls on Instagram, where you can expect to get sneak peeks, additional learning content, and the most up-to-date details on show release times. And don't forget, you can head to our Linktree at linktree.com/PC Pearls and click on Send Us a Voice Message to send us your questions, reflections, and personal experiences. We'd love to hear from you. And if you could, please leave us a rating and a review. Don't forget to subscribe to Primary Care Pearls wherever you get your podcasts so that you can stay up to date on new episode releases. Thanks again for joining us today. Farewell from all of us at the Primary Care Pearls podcast. We'll catch you in the next one.